on the 2nd and 3rd of August. I'm very excited to hear you.
Well, I'm sort of excited to hear what I'm going to say, too. You never quite know.
Well, I suppose there's some truth to that, but you've mentioned that you're going to talk a little bit about LDS apologetics, and at some point here, well, maybe now's a good time. I ought to mention that if anyone listening would like to be part of the FAIR conference, it's open to the general public. You can sign up by going to the website fairlds.org, and the prices are quite reasonable. You can sign up for one day or two. It's next week, next Thursday and Friday, the Southtown Expo Center in Sandy, Utah. It will be absolutely fabulous. The list of wonderful speakers is just phenomenal. So everyone's invited who would like to join. With that little intro, tell us a little bit about apologetics and its place within the faith. I know that's an important subject for you.
Yeah, it really is. You know, a lot of people, when they hear the word apologetics, want to know, what in the world are you apologizing for? Or why do you feel it necessary to apologize for your faith? And we don't need to apologize for being Mormons. Well, that's not what the word apologetics means. Apologeo in Greek means to defend, so initially the idea of apologizing was not to say you're sorry, but to defend what you'd done. I mean, it goes back to, to defend a position. It goes back to Socrates. Plato wrote the Apology of Socrates. When Socrates goes before that court in Athens that eventually puts him to death, if you read the document, he's not saying I'm sorry. He's defending his way of life and what he was doing, you know, questioning the traditional beliefs and so on. And so that's what apologetics is about, is defending beliefs. Now, everybody does that. We do it all the time. We defend positions that we hold. People say, well, why are you voting for Obama? Or why are you voting for Romney? You know, the proper response is to say, I'm doing it because X, Y, and Z. Or why do you think the Mets are the best team in baseball? Well, this is why. And so in religion, too, when you assert a position, a lot of people are going to say, well, I don't believe that. Justify what you're saying. Or, you know, how can you believe that? How can you possibly believe something like that? So, as the New Testament says, be prepared to give to every man a reason for the hope that is within you. And the word that's actually used there is apologia, to give an explanation, a defense of your belief. And so it's a very important thing to me. And we all do it. I mean, when missionaries are sent out, we don't just say, you know, humans lived before they were born into this life. We say, humans were born before they lived in this life, and here are some scriptures that illustrate this. We present evidence. We try to convince people that our view is biblical. It's correct.
That is such an important point, and one of the, sadly, I guess in a way, but to be expected, one of the hallmarks of the LDS faith is that it has been attacked almost from its inception, which has required a defense of the faith.
Yeah.
There's a great history that Farms has put together in various little publications about anti-Mormon literature and those who have responded to it.
Yeah. It goes back right to the beginning. I mean, you're getting anti-Mormon stuff before the church is founded. There are attacks on the Book of Mormon and so on and so forth. And so from a very early stage, you get a vigorous response on the part of Latter-day Saints. Orson and Parley Pratt, for example, Orson Spencer, John Taylor. Now, there's some pretty heroic defenders of the faith from the start, and it carries on through B.H. Roberts to Hugh Nibley and beyond.
And it does. And tell our listening audience how you first became involved in apologetics, or what drew you to it.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in Southern California in a very non-Mormon environment. I was the only active Mormon practically that I can recall at my high school. And so people were always questioning, you know, what on earth nonsense is this? And I even had some teachers, one in particular who was an evangelical of some sort, and he used his class as a platform for attacking the Mormons. So there was plenty of opportunity to try to defend oneself there. And then serving a mission, we came under attack. Most missionaries are familiar with this. And I became the sort of mission specialist in dealing with criticisms, for good or for ill. But then I remember one particular incident. After my wife and I were married, we were staying at my brother's house in Southern California, and we overslept and missed his early morning meetings on Sunday morning. So I looked up the address of the church to see if there was another ward. Well, there was an organization that billed itself as the Church of Jesus Christ of Ex-Latter-day Saints. And I thought, oh, now that's intriguing. So I called them up. Well, of course, there was no church, but there was a recorded message, and I left a comment. And I got a response from them. I left my address and said, go ahead, contact me. So it started a correspondence, and I've kind of been in it ever since.
Very interesting. Being from Southern California territory, I'm sure Walter Martin was a name that...
Oh, yes. Yeah, Walter Martin was a big, big name, and he's seemingly everywhere, you know, the impresario of anti-Mormonism and the counter-cult.
It's fascinating how that tradition of attacking the LDS faith has been so vigorous and so sustained over the years, and yet I know that one of the papers that was done quite some time ago at what was then Farms sort of tracked, and the more anti-Mormon press that there is or publications, the better the church has seemed to do.
Yeah, it's a really odd phenomenon. I remember talking with, you know, back in the days when they had older brethren who were missionaries on Temple Square, so this is ages ago, they haven't done that for a long time. But I remember once going to Temple Square for some reason, and I had to fight my way through a phalanx of anti-Mormons waving placards and handing out literature and everything. And I got inside. I took as much of their literature as I could, you know, some to look at and the rest to trash. But there was an older missionary standing there, and I just said to him, gee, you know, this is awful. You know, how can you guys stand it? And he said, well, you'd be surprised. He said, on the days that they're not there, visitors come to Temple Square, and they're a little bit, you know, standoffish. They're nervous. They're interested, but they're afraid we're going to push them into the font. But he said, when they're out there, by the time visitors make it through that, people are on our side. They're so offended by that that they want to hear what we have to say, you know. He said, you can tell the difference. And I don't know that I necessarily want anti-Mormons to ring Temple Square and harass us at our meetings and everything, but they may not be as effective as they think they are. You know, the street screamers, street screechers, or whatever you want to call them, that used to be around here so much. I can't imagine there was ever anybody who was motivated to consider evangelical Christianity by them. They just seem to me to make Mormons look better by contrast.
Very true. And I know some of the people who have been fairly antagonistic, like James White comes to mind, although I've gotten along fairly well with him over the years, has sort of abandoned the Temple Square conference thing because he thinks it's gotten completely out of hand, which is really amazing.
Yeah. So in some ways, I'm grateful for them. If this is our opposition, you know, just look at them. Which do you prefer, this nice Mormon family over here or this guy yelling insults at you with a megaphone? Who represents Christianity to you?
Absolutely. If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Professor Daniel Peterson of Brigham Young University. He will be speaking at the FAIR Conference, which will be happening next week on Thursday and Friday in the Southtown Expo Center in Sandy, Utah. If you'd like to attend, please do go on the internet, fairlds.org. It's going to be an absolutely fabulous conference. There will be speakers like John Gee, wonderful LDS Egyptologist John Sorensen, who chronicled the map of the lands of the Book of Mormon.
Religion Today with Martin Tanner continues on KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
Welcome back. I'm Martin Tanner, your host. This is Religion Today. If you would like to be in touch with me about this or any other subjects, if you want to throw rocks or if you want to ask questions or whatever you'd like to do, send me an email. Send it to martinstanner@gmail.com. I'll be happy to respond. In studio with me today is Professor Daniel Peterson of Brigham Young University, who has been, over the years, a wonderful defender of the faith, and sort of in honor of that great place that he holds, he's going to be the concluding speaker at the FAIR Conference yet again this year, like every other year, and it's going to be wonderful to hear from him. Before we took our break, we talked a little bit about the history of anti-Mormonism and the responses to it. Let's sort of move things forward a little bit and talk about what you've been involved with, which has been Farms, Maxwell Institute. Talk about maybe the history of recent LDS apologetics and where you see apologetics of the LDS faith going in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the sort of creator, the godfather of modern Mormon apologetics would have to be Hugh Nibley. I think if you look around, a lot of us who are involved in this kind of thing, we've all been at one point or another hugely influenced by Hugh Nibley, students of Hugh's or certainly readers of his books. It's kind of interesting because he didn't really have, in the generation following his, he didn't have any successors, and he was worried about that, I'm told. It was really sort of his grandchildren, in effect, that took up the mantle. And I know for a fact that he was really quite relieved toward the end of his life that there was a movement to sort of carry the torch, pick up the torch and carry it on. And that really began with the foundation, or the founding, I should say, of the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, or FARMS, as it was called, in Southern California. The principal person behind that was, of course, Jack Welch, who was then a lawyer in Southern California and has now long since joined the law faculty at BYU. And Jack was, I've always thought, sort of created by divine decree or something like that to do what he did, because he's your typical Mormon lawyer who happens to have really strong interest in and degrees in ancient languages, ancient history, and a specialty in tax-exempt foundations and that sort of thing. I mean, there can't be too many of those wandering around. So I really think he was born to do what he did, and he established FARMS, the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, and then when he joined the faculty at BYU, it moved up with him. Now, it wasn't much to move at that time. It was given some low-priority space in a BYU building that wasn't much used, and then it began to grow. And gradually others joined. I came on a few years later after I joined the faculty at BYU. And then we began to receive donations. I remember the first time we got a substantial donation. I won't say how much it was. It was much smaller than some we've received since then, but it was the biggest thing we had ever seen. And the office manager, well, he took a call and the fellow said, I'm a mission president, and what you've done is so helpful to my missionaries. Do you accept donations? And our office manager said, well, yeah, I guess we do. And he said, well, then I'll send you something. And when it came, we were stunned. It was so big that he called us down. We all came down to the office to look at the check. So it was a pretty shoestring operation to begin with. But it grew and it grew and it began to publish books. John Sorensen's An Ancient American Setting for the Book of Mormon was one of the very earliest things that we ever did. Then it launched periodicals, like what was initially the Review of Books on the Book of Mormon, then became eventually the Farms Review, and then briefly the Mormon Studies Review. And that was initially a review of everything published on the Book of Mormon. Then it began to broaden its focus. We launched a journal of Book of Mormon studies. And so that became sort of the happening place for not just apologetics. I mean, it was also general studies on the Book of Mormon and related topics from a sort of ancient point of view. That is, our assumption was, let's assume, as a working hypothesis, of course it's more than that for us, but as scholars, a working hypothesis, this stuff really is ancient. How does that shed light on it? How can we make sense of it? How does it fit into the ancient world? And we found, overwhelmingly, that was a very fruitful way of reading it, that Joseph Smith's scriptures really did fit the ancient world, that there was more in them, certainly in my judgment, than you could account for from his environment.
Absolutely. I had the great honor of speaking with Jack Welch, who found out that there was chiasmus in the Book of Mormon, this ancient literary form,
yeah,
which was astounding. And tell our listening audience, who may not be so familiar, some of the other things that were found that lend credence to the idea that the Book of Mormon really is an ancient book.
Yeah, well, there are any number of things that we could talk about. chiasmus is certainly one of them. The fact that there were literary forms in the Book of Mormon that Joseph Smith almost certainly never knew anything about, but that turn out to be characteristic of Semitic literature. There are names in the Book of Mormon that seem to fit the environment from which the Book of Mormon claims to come. Alma and Paanchi and Korihor, for that matter. These names fit their environment. The idea of sealing up plates with sacred text written on them to come forth at a future time. You study the Dead Sea Scrolls and you realize that's what they did. You know, they wrote their documents mostly on parchment, but in some cases actually on metal plates. And then faced with military destruction, they sealed them up in a hillside to come forth at some future time. And it was done by a community at Qumran along the Dead Sea, led by a council of three Levitical priests, who were underneath them. There were 12 laymen. You know, that's not the first presence in 12, but boy, it makes me suspicious.
It's pretty close.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, just point after point after point, we find things that seem to fit the ancient world in a remarkable way. You know, right down to the way the books of the Book of Mormon open, or with if and conditional sentences in the original manuscript, where, you know, as we would say in English, you know, if this guy doesn't shut up soon, I'll go mad. Or, you know, if you don't come by 10 o'clock, then I'll know you're not coming at all. In classical Hebrew, you say if and. If he doesn't shut up soon, and I'll go mad. If you don't come by 10 o'clock, and I'll know you're not coming at all. It's very bad English. No English speaker has ever spoken like that in any dialect, in any region, at any period. But in the original manuscript of the Book of Mormon, you find sentences like that. Which I think Joseph Smith goes through in, you know, the 1837 edition, and he probably says, what in the world is that? And he cleans it up. But what it is a mark of authentic Hebraic style. And those are the kinds of things that we found. They're little things. You know, no one of them is a knockout punch, but cumulatively, to me, they make a really strong and persuasive case.
They absolutely do, and it's phenomenal work that Farms has done over the years to show the historicity of the Book of Mormon, or at least make a wonderful case for that. I don't know that anybody can absolutely prove it. We didn't have any telephones back then, any recording devices, any video devices, but it's remarkable what you find there. Even the Reformed Egyptian and the idea of Hebrew written in Egyptian, all these things have been found.
Right, right. Yeah, people make fun of it. One of the things that I really am impressed by is the discovery of a place called Nehem, right where Nehem in the Book of Mormon is. And if you go due east from that, you land at the one place on the Arabian Sea coast, Wadi Saik, that has seemingly all the characteristics you need for Book of Mormon Old World Bountiful. You've got a protected bay, you've got wood, you've got fresh water, you've got greenery, you've got iron ore. Again, I just ask, how would Joseph Smith have known that? And the fact is that name goes back, Nehem, or Nehem, goes back to exactly the time of Lehi. We can now prove that. That's a bullseye. That's not only a bullseye, it's a double bullseye. And, you know, again, you can say, well, it's just sheer chance or something like that, but the odds begin to be astronomically high against it.
Absolutely so. It has been wonderful to talk to you today. If you who are listening would like to hear Professor Peterson at the Fair Conference, go online to lds.org and sign up. It'll be next Thursday and Friday at the Expo Center in Sandy. It will be absolutely worth your while. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.